From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Shortly after his inauguration, President Trump signed an executive order temporarily barring entry to the U.S. for citizens from seven predominantly Muslim countries. Within days, State Department employees issued a dissent cable to the newly confirmed Secretary of State.
Drafts of the memo say Trump's immigration ban is a betrayal of American values. They add, quote, "We are better than this." The immigration ban triggered mass protests worldwide.
Christopher Richardson was stationed in Madrid as American Citizen Service Chief at the time. The Emory graduate was among those working for the State Department to register their concerns, namely that the ban would embolden anti-American groups, making the nation less safe. Last month, the Supreme Court upheld the ban. By then, Chris had resigned from his post and now works as an immigration lawyer at Nelson Mullins Riley in Scarborough. He's with us today to talk about the making and unmaking of a career diplomat. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
So glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
So why did you want to work for the Department of State?
Since I was a kid, I really had this idea that I wanted to travel, see the world, and represent my country. And I thought that the State Department, working as a diplomat, would be the best mechanism to do so.
So let's learn about you as a kid. You're originally from Charleston, South Carolina, right?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
So what was it like growing up there?
Well, it started off, my earliest memories were of actually just me and my mom. My mom was a single mom when I grew up. You know, we lived in one of the roughest neighborhoods in Charleston up until my mom then met my stepdad. Who was this 50-year-old white man from rural Pennsylvania as a coal miner. And my mom's this African-American woman. And these two made an interesting mix for me because my stepdad also had two white children. And so we made a multicultural Brady Bunch, essentially. And as a kid, I learned to navigate this intersection of race and class. And it made me understand better the need for diplomacy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Problems.
Well, you also had cancer as a child.
Yes, I did.
How old were you?
I was 15 years old when I had cancer.
What happened? What kind of cancer was it?
I had osteogenic sarcoma, which is a type of bone cancer. I had it both in my lung and most of my right leg at the time.
Mm. So what do you remember from going through this? You know, at 15 years old, in this family, young African-American man, biracial, half siblings who were white. What was that all? Give us the sense of that swirl at the time.
Oh, at the time, well, I had like pain in my knee for several months, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor did an X-ray and discovered this huge grapefruit-sized tumor in my leg and in my lung, and the doctor basically told me at the time that because it had already been in my lung, that I probably had a year to live, maybe 5 years if I were lucky. And, you know, my mom and dad were shocked by that, obviously, and I was shocked, too. But it was so good to have my dad there at that time, who was a strong man and capable, and my mom as well. Both of them went through a very, very difficult period with health insurance, with chemotherapy, with losing most of my right leg, losing a part of my lung, losing friends, and thinking they were going to lose me as well. But I didn't die. That was 22 years ago. Thanks be to God, I'm still here.
Well, clearly you made it.
Yeah.
And you went on to go to Emory, study political science and history, and then Duke Law School, some very big, prestigious schools. A lot of people from, especially if they have poor families early on, struggle with feeling like an outsider in those kind of top-tier colleges. Did you?
Yeah, you know, for me, when you survive something like cancer, and even coming from, you know, working class families, but especially when you survive something like cancer, everything else in life is kind of easy. You know, when a doctor tells you and you have to process this idea that you're going to die, and you don't die, then, you know, you go into these environments and situations like the Emory and the Duke, where you might be different, but you also feel that, you know, I can do this. I've been through worse, and I can definitely fight and survive and thrive in this kind of environment or any environment I'm put in.
And you decided to go into foreign service. You were practiced law for a while, but took the foreign service exam, which is no joke. Did you, obviously, you know, growing up gave you this sense of, you said, practiced in diplomacy. But do you think that was part of your ambition to solve problems for the rest of the world?
No. I went into it, you know, thinking that I would be a part of the American story and a part of helping the United States in what little way I possibly could, and also to represent the United States and its values. Despite everything that's happened in our country's history, I have a strong love and faith in our country. I have a strong love and faith in our values. And I really thought that, and I still think that this is something as a diplomat that you can do to represent your country, not only externally, but also in who you are and how you speak about the country. And just having people in all these parts of the world where I've been see me as a young African-American and say, well, hey, if the United States can put him in a position of diplomacy, then why can't my country do the same?
Hmm. So you went on, your first post was in Lagos, Nigeria. So when was that?
That was in 2011, 2012.
And you were a consular officer.
Yes.
So what does that do? What do you do?
Basically, as a consular officer, there are two or three prongs, really. One prong is that you work in visas, and the other prong is that you work in American citizen services. I spent a year doing visas, which is basically interviewing people who want to come to the United States to live or to work or to just visit. I did that for about a year. And then the other part of the year, I worked as the American Citizen Services Chief, which basically means that I did stuff as mundane as helping Americans who lost passports to as intense as negotiating with the government over the remains of U.S. citizens.
Mm. We're talking today about the making of a diplomat with Christopher Richardson. He worked as a Foreign Service officer for the State Department and posts around the world. He resigned in January of this year. He's now an immigration lawyer in Atlanta. Well, what did you learn about the vision of the rest of the world or the relationship between the United States and the world in those little interactions for the State Department in Lagos?
What I found is that I think a lot of people in the United States, when they look at a lot of these countries, they have strong preconceived notions about what they think about us. And Americans have these notions about what these countries are like that just aren't in relation to what they were. I think that for me in Nigeria, especially, the people there love the United States. They look up to the United States. They revere the United States and its democracy. And what I learned in my travels and working in embassies around the world is that so many people have such adoration for the United States because of its democratic principles. And that's something that made me have even more pride in my country, because I really felt that in seeing the way these other countries looked up to us and saw us as the beacons of what every country should aspire to be, that was something that I was glad to be a part of.
But you were the guy, or worked with people on the other side of the desk when people were coming to you. They wanted to get to the U.S. They wanted visas. What were some of the stories that people were coming to you with?
You know, sometimes it'd be as simple as, hey, I want to take my kids to Disney World to do a tour, and that would be okay. But there were other stories of people seeking medical care, people wanting to study at Harvard and Yale, people in need of traveling to the U.S. to visit sick relatives, people who married American citizens and wanted to reunite with their families, children who had parents who lived in the United States and wanted to be reunited with their parents. A lot of the visa stories were really stories of reunification with American citizen family members. And I did tens of thousands of visa interviews across four countries. And, you know, every one of those stories was an individual who had their own story and their own desire and wish to travel to the U.S. or to be reunited with someone that they knew in the United States.
How often do you switch posts generally in the diplomatic corps?
Generally every 2 to 3 years. For the harder countries like Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan, it's a year. But for the most part, you move from country to country every 2-3 years.
What's the rationale behind that?
The rationale is that you don't want your diplomatic corps to become more loyal to that country than to the United States. I think that that's not that is what the thinking is that if you're in a country for too long, if you live in Spain for 5 years or 6 years, or if you live in France for 5 or 6 years, that somehow you'll lose sight of American values or lose sight of the country and may become more loyal or more sympathetic or more understanding, I guess, of that country instead of what it might be the value of the United States or what's important to the United States.
And generally, do you work with locals inside of the embassies? The consulate staff is generally locals or Americans? Or
Most of the consular staff and most of the staff in embassies are actually locals. When I was in Pakistan, for example, in Karachi, the vast majority of our staff were all local Pakistani citizens. The people who guarded us were Pakistani citizens. Same in Nigeria. The vast majority of the staff are local staff, and the people who guard us and protect us and make sure that we're safe are local staff members, people who live in that country, people who are citizens of that country, but who have great appreciation and deep respect for the United States and work on behalf of the United States, even though they aren't American citizens.
So you were working in Karachi, Pakistan, mm-hmm. in, what, 2015, 2016?
Yes.
Okay. So this is at a time when, let's say, diplomatic relations with the U.S. were pretty tense, you know, that mm-hmm. Pakistan was traditionally a partner in the so-called war on terror. But there was a question about their loyalty. So I'm just wondering what it's like for you. You know, you're facing local people on a daily basis, but you're also adhering to American foreign policy. Did that ever feel like there was a split for you?
Oh, absolutely. When I was in Pakistan, I was the American Citizen Services Chief in Karachi. And what that entailed is many times American citizens would be in danger. A lot of times you saw American women who married Pakistani citizens, and then they would move back to Pakistan. And the husband would, you know, say that, oh, I want to live in a conservative household. And sometimes you would see extreme situations where women were imprisoned and they would escape and come to the consulate. And a lot of times, you know, the Pakistani government would help us, and a lot of times they wouldn't. They would say this wasn't a problem. And so you got a sense, but sometimes they would help us. And so you got a sense that the government itself felt very schizophrenic sometimes, where sometimes you would pick up the phone and you could anticipate someone helping you. But other times they wouldn't, and then you would have to get really creative to try to help rescue these women and these children who were in incredible danger.
Well, creativity is part of the job for you, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, okay, so then you moved on to Madrid as American Citizens Service Chief. We're going to learn a little bit about that. We're talking today about the making of a diplomat with Chris Richardson, who worked as a Foreign Service Officer for the State Department and posts around the world. He resigned in January of this year. Just ahead, a glimpse into the dissent process for employees of the State Department when my conversation with Chris Richardson continues. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Days after his confirmation as Secretary of State in late April of this year, Mike Pompeo spoke to State Department employees.
As I've said, and I'll elaborate more, I want the State Department to get its swagger back. We need our men and women out at the front lines, executing American diplomacy with great vigor and energy.
The agency had hobbled along with low morale and job vacancies under Pompeo's predecessor, Rex Tillerson. By January of 2018, more than half of the top-ranking diplomats had quit. Christopher Richardson was among those who left. He's now an immigration attorney in Georgia, and we're talking about his experience as one of thousands of diplomatic staff stationed around the world. Now, Chris, you worked in foreign posts under three secretaries of state. Have I got that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So who was in that role when you started back in Lagos?
Hillary Clinton was then secretary of state, and then John Kerry, and then Rex Tillerson.
So the leadership style of those at the head, could that be felt throughout the organization?
Absolutely. I think that when you have a Secretary of State that has a great appreciation for the officers, that is something that you could feel and you can see just in their interaction and just in the things that they say. But when you have a Secretary of State that does not like the State Department or maybe feels indifference to it, that's also something that you can feel and tell just by the body language and just by the statements that they make. And while those statements may not target the State Department, you know exactly what they're trying to say.
Well, also, you were there in 2012 when Benghazi happened. This was under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. How did that attack and those deaths reverberate among the diplomatic corps in these disparate places across the world?
I think that for all of us, we were in shock. I work with people who knew people who were there in Libya. And I think that a lot of us were very concerned about our own safety. But we also felt that the politics of the time, that we were being used as fodder, that our lives were basically being used as a political talking point for certain sides, and that there really wasn't an interest in actually investigating and figuring out what was going on, but instead there was an interest in scoring political points more than anything else. And so I think that while some of us were shocked by what happened, we were also infuriated by the political landscape at that time. Within a day of the attack happening, you had people on TV and radio essentially saying, well, you know, this is all this person's fault and that person's fault, and this would never happen under me. And we were all like, hey, wait a minute. Can we have a second to mourn the lives of these individuals? And can we talk about important stuff and not just pointing fingers at people?
Well, this became a huge partisan flashpoint, as you know. But also, Rex Tillerson, he was somewhat controversial, did seem to express a certain indifference to the organization or the agency that he was leading. He was confirmed early on in the Trump administration. Now, the travel ban had been announced just days before. A few days after the inauguration, you all got a cable. You were then in Madrid. How was the intent and execution of the travel ban explained to you?
When the travel ban, or as I call it, the Muslim ban, came out, we were all stunned. I think that a lot of us were stunned, not only because it made no sense, but also because there was clearly no attempt to buy in or talk to actual people who will implement this policy beforehand. It was clearly written by some, maybe Stephen Miller or other people in the administration. They really didn't get any buy-in or talk to anyone. They misspelled the word consular. There were misspellings in it. There were all these loopholes. There was chaos at the airports. And for all of us, we were just angry at what it meant. And so thousands of us signed on to this dissent cable. Basically, we all just received emails from people saying, hey, I'm circulating this dissent cable. And you know, we all signed on to it. There was talk of doing walkouts. There was talk of a strike. There was a lot of dissent within the diplomatic corps and a lot of discussion about what we could possibly do to stand up to what we felt was both this Muslim ban, but also to the incoming secretary's desire to cut the State Department budget, and a sense that we were being targeted for basically being, you know, what they perceived to be Hillary Clinton's organization. And I think that's something that people don't realize, is that the State Department was very much seen in the White House and in other circles as not this diplomatic corps of nonpartisan individuals, but as being a target, being the quote-unquote deep state. And therefore, we deserve to have our budget cut, and we deserve to go through these things. And it's interesting you mentioned Benghazi, because that was a talking point for 4 years, but the person who's supposed to be the assistant for diplomatic security was never appointed. Basically, everyone stopped talking about actual diplomatic security, and our budget was cut in security. And so it's fascinating for us as diplomats that, you know, we heard for 4 years about how our security was so important, our lives were so important, and then the minute there's a change in administration, all of that went away.
Well, the people who worked for the State Department describe it as being sort of hollowed out at that time in the first year, anyway, of the new administration. But I want to go back to you saying the travel ban is a Muslim ban. Now, you were told this is not a Muslim ban. Did people in the Muslim world perceive it as that?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people who are friends of mine in Pakistan and Nigeria in particular, they would ask me, why is the United States banning Muslims? And I would, you know, explain it and quibble and say, well, you know, it's not really a Muslim ban. It's just a ban on these particular people from this particular country. And we're going to pretend like this has nothing to do with what the president said in December 2015 when he said, I'm calling for a complete and total shutdown of all Muslims entering the United States.
This was on the campaign trail in what, Charleston?
In Charleston. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about this process, the dissent channel process. This is something that all these people from around the world in these posts signed on to. But this is not unprecedented. There's actually a system for this in the State Department.
Right. In the State Department, since the Vietnam era, when State Department officials and diplomats basically want to channel dissent with a policy, basically, they use something that we call a dissent channel cable, where basically you write a cable dissenting to a cable is like a memorandum for the file, basically dissenting to the policy and the procedure. But the dissent cable that we did with the thousands of signatures, that was unprecedented, that you saw that many officers signing on to something like this before.
Typically, a couple of them a year or something
right.
like that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So is there freedom from reprisal for dissent cables?
With this dissent cable, it was interesting that the then secretary, press secretary Spicer, basically was asked about this dissent cable immediately after it came out. And he said, you know, if these diplomats don't get with the program, then they need to get out of the State Department.
Did you hear that as a threat?
Yeah, we did hear that as a threat. I don't think that there was actually any real repercussions, but it certainly, Secretary Tillerson never responded to it, as far as I know. And it certainly, I think, contributed to his idea that he was working in enemy territory, that he actually wasn't working for the State Department, but that he was working against the State Department. And the fact that this was the first thing that he saw when he entered the his office, I think it added to a bad environment for him when he started.
So no response at all from Secretary Tillerson. Did the dissenters come up with a strategy or some other way to work within this policy?
At the time, I think that all of us were, and I include myself in this, we were all angry and shocked and frustrated. But then the court stepped in and the courts blocked the first iteration of the ban. And here's where it gets interesting. After the first iteration of the ban gets blocked, the administration learns from its mistakes and goes to us, the State Department, and says, hey, we want to make this as palpable and as able to pass court muster as possible. So the very people who wrote this dissent cable and protested and were frustrated suddenly became the vehicles by which we were going to enforce the Muslim ban.
I'm curious how you talked about that amongst yourselves. I'm sure there were some people who thought it was a good idea, some who didn't. What was that conversation like inside of your post and other State Department's posts?
In talking to my friends, you know, across the world, a lot of us felt that, well, we have to stay in this job to basically save this administration and save this administration and this country from itself, that unless we do something to moderate this discrimination, and unless we do something to placate and make this a softer form of discrimination, that, you know, then people after us who come in will be worse and that they will somehow make this more of a hard ban. And so for a lot of State Department people and people who are diplomats, they felt that they had to stay in to basically moderate what they saw and knew to be discrimination.
Not to mention that working for the State Department in a foreign post, that's a pretty good gig, right?
Yeah. You get free housing. You get a lot of free air travel. It's a very comfortable job. And Spain was the most comfortable place of a very comfortable job. You know, you get a big apartment. You get to live really close to the center of town. It has a lot of advantages. But I think that for myself and for others, we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing as this is all going on? Are we going to be a party even on the surface? Or are we going to be a party to what we know to be discrimination and what we know to be serious problems going on in our country?
We're getting a glimpse into the life of an American diplomat with Christopher Richardson. He and his State Department colleagues may be the first Americans people meet when applying for visas at consulates and embassies around the world. He resigned in January of this year and is now an immigration lawyer in Atlanta. So you are on the front lines, aren't you? I mean, are you the people who were, at that time, doing the vetting of whether people should come into the U.S. or not?
Yes. It's interesting that the administration, during its argument with the Supreme Court, said that we as consular officers had total discretion, but that's not true. In fact, consular officers have some discretion and some ability to do the extreme vetting, but know that there's like an entire different policy set up in Washington, D.C. that also vetted people as well. Various government agencies also took part in the vetting. So it wasn't just us as consular officers, even though the administration says it's just us. In fact, it's not just us who took part in extreme vetting and also took part in banning people from these seven countries.
So after a while, you went through this process, waited for these court cases, but then finally in 2018 decided to quit. I know why, because I read about it, but I just want to remind you that there are some words you can't say on the radio, and I think that one of those words was a trigger for you.
Yeah. In January, the president said that countries like Nigeria and countries where I served were S-hole countries, I'll put it that way. And I felt at that time that I just could not do this anymore. Prior to the State Department and during the State Department, I wrote a book about the civil rights movement called The Historical Dictionary of the Civil Rights Movement. And I read a lot about the civil rights movement, and I read a lot of speeches from Martin Luther King. And one of his speeches, he talks about Rip Van Winkle. The story of Rip Van Winkle is that in 1760, Rip Van Winkle goes up on a mountain, and in 1780, when he comes down, he goes on the mountain, he goes to sleep. And when he comes down, 20 years later, he looks and he sees that instead of a picture of George III, there's a picture of George Washington. And Martin Luther King says that, you know, this guy, Rip Van Winkle, basically slept through a revolution, that he slept through the American Revolution. And Martin Luther King asks us, are we sleeping through a revolution? And you should ask yourself, are you sleeping through something that's profoundly damaging? Are you sleeping through things that are really important? And I didn't want to find myself in 20 or 30 years looking back on this era of children and cages and bans and walls, asking myself, well, what did I do during that time? What did I take part in this? Was I guilty in this? I don't want to look back on this and say that I slept through a revolution. And I think that is what compelled me to say that I needed to be out there doing everything I could to help immigrants fight for their rights and the rights of American citizens who love immigrants, or people who have children who are immigrants, or people who are married to immigrants, that they have rights too. And so I felt that I was better outside of the system than I would be serving in it.
So about 60% of the diplomatic corps had left by that point. Others had stayed. You can speak freely about your opinion now. Do those who stayed, what's your conversation like with them now? How are things for them?
I think a lot of them, some of them are very frustrated with people like me because they feel that, you know, you're going out there and you're telling, you know, about the low morale and, you know, you're talking bad about the State Department, but I'm not talking bad about those people. I think that those who stay, I understand why they stay. I know a lot of them, they would leave if they could. But I know a lot of them feel that, you know, they're the last guardians of the gate, that, you know, they're the ones that are keeping us from total chaos, and that they are using their expertise to make these things as soft as possible. But I think that for me personally, that is part of the problem, that, you know, the current separation of families is a perfect example. And I think that the president's desire to separate families is rooted in our reaction to the Muslim ban. the fact that we all flooded the airports, we protested, we wrote the most creative signs, and then the courts got involved, and then it got muddled, and then the president said, okay, so I'm going to do like a moderate discriminatory ban. And we said, okay, that's okay. As a country, that's what we said. And it's the same now with the separating of the families. You know, we're out there, we're protesting, we're angry, we make creative signs. And then, you know, the president says, okay, so I'm going to put the entire family unit together in a cage. And we say, oh, that's great. You know, that's good that we do that. And so I think that for us, it's something that we, as a State Department, just didn't fight against enough.
Well, Chris, we're going to pick up this conversation and talk a little bit about that just ahead, the role of diplomacy in today's geopolitical environment and life after the State Department, when my conversation with Chris Richardson continues. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's been more than 62 years since a jury acquitted the two men charged with murdering Emmett Till. The case has now been reopened based on some new information. The 14-year-old African-American was kidnapped and brutally murdered for allegedly whistling at a white woman. Well, tomorrow we're going to talk to Hank Klibanoff, host of the Buried Truths podcast, about investigating this and other civil rights cold cases. What questions or information do you have about the murder that helped ignite the civil rights movement? You can leave us a voicemail. We're at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and Facebook. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. We are continuing our conversation with Christopher Richardson, who is just getting amped up at the end of that last segment. He's a former U.S. diplomat and now attorney at an Atlanta firm. And since leaving the State Department, he has been free to share his views on how U.S. immigration policy affects opinion abroad. Well, Chris, clearly this is something that you opposed. Many of your colleagues did as well. But the Supreme Court did uphold the Muslim ban. That president does have authority to make this kind of policy. Now, you're a lawyer. How would you have argued that case?
I think I wouldn't have done much differently than what the lawyers did in that case. I do think that probably the mistake that they made is that they went for a quick win. In the Ninth Circuit, instead of doing the discovery process. I think that had they done the discovery process, which basically means that, you know, you have to produce documents, both sides have to produce documents. And had they gone through that and gone a lot slower and meticulous, that they would have made the government produce documents about certain features of the ban that would have raised a lot of questions. And that might have strengthened the argument for why this was a ban and why it's unconstitutional and why it's not even based in rational decision-making.
Your primary case that you talked about earlier and in the dissent cable was that the ban actually endangered Americans more. On what grounds?
That in a sense that it feeds into this idea that the United States is against Islam as a religion, that we as a country have decided that Muslims, whether they be American Muslims or Muslims abroad, are our enemy, and that they must be targeted for this. Now, what they argue is that, well, we only pick 7 of the countries, so it's okay. But, you know, even if you pick just one country and it's rooted in this discriminatory animus, that's wrong. And I think that that's something that we could have stressed, probably they could have stressed a little bit more in the legal case.
Well, along with the protests of those against the travel ban, there were plenty of people who were supporting it. CNN spoke to some right here in Georgia.
I'm glad to see our president taking the actions that he needs to take to provide the highest degree of security for the American citizenry that he possibly can.
I'm aware that we're just a few steps removed from terrible things that could happen, and I'm okay with a temporary stop so that we can reevaluate where we are.
So our political system has, of course, our country is very divided about so many issues, and this is one of them, drawing lines, laying down battlegrounds. So you, diplomat, problem solver, this is what your career has been focused on. What do you say to people who disagree in this way?
What I would say is that, you know, one of the big myths about the history of African Americans was that after the Civil War and after slavery, African Americans didn't have freedom basically for another 100 years. And that's not true. After 1865, for 10 brief years, African Americans had the right to vote, had all sorts of rights. There were hundreds of elected officials who were African Americans for 10 brief years after the Civil War. But 40 years after that, there were no rights for African Americans. And the reason is because we as a country watched and sat by, and moderates sat by, as African-American rights were basically assaulted. And that, you know, if you allow bad things to happen to people, quote unquote, on a temporary basis, then it's only a matter of time before your own rights might be affected. That would be the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is the United States already has an array of security features. We do extreme vetting. We have something called security advisory opinions. If you come for a visa interview, you were already vetted long before this occurred. What this is basically a promise that this president wanted to keep, saying that he did a complete and total shutdown of Muslims in the country. And so I would say that it's not only that it's just unnecessary. America already had tons of security features long before this ban ever was put into effect.
The State Department, for the most part, was sidelined under Tillerson early on in the administration. This is part of a historic tug of war between the Department of State and Department of Diplomacy. Make the case for state, for problem solving, for coming together rather than a military response to problems around the world.
I think that Secretary Mattis with the Department of Defense, he actually said that, you know, if you don't hire more State Department people, I'm going to need a lot more bullets because I'm going to need that to basically solve, quote unquote, solve some of these problems. The thing about the State Department is that we are the people in these countries who are negotiating and working on your behalf as American citizens. They're the ones that are out there risking their lives every day to bring people together. They speak the local language. They have a good and unique understanding of these countries. And therefore, they're the best people in the best position to represent our country and to go to these meetings and meet with people and assist Americans as well who might be in jail or who might be in trouble abroad. These are the people who are representing you. And they are the best educated, and they are really smart, intelligent people who work really hard and have made really great deals and peace negotiations on behalf of the American people.
So what did it mean for you to leave? You were inside of the system where you could work on policy or live it out, see it lived out in a certain way, and now you're not.
I think that for me, the thing about the State Department is that, yes, we're very, very good at diplomacy, but I think that we're almost too good at it, that there are times in life when you're supposed to be flexible, and there are other times in life when you're supposed to be inflexible. Really quick, one story about the State Department that's sort of representative of the State Department is when the first African-American diplomat went to what we call the Foreign Service Institute in Virginia. His name was Terrence Todman. Basically, and Virginia was segregated at that time. Half the people in the State Department thought that Terrence should be able to eat in the all-whites-only cafeteria, and the other half of the State Department said, no, Terrence should not be able to eat in the whites-only part of the cafeteria. So what the State Department did was split the room in the middle and make it half whites only and half for integrated. And the State Department said, look, we solved this problem. And I think that sometimes in life we have to say, you know what, there are some things that you can't just compromise and solve, and that you actually have to have a voice and stand up for things. And so while I love my former colleagues, and I think that they're the best at finding solutions to every problem, some problems you actually have to stand up and raise your voice and do something about.
You tell the story about your stepfather punching someone who called you the N-word.
Yes. Yes.
So when do you know when to fight? When do you know when to try and be the peacemaker?
I think that, you know, most things in life, I think you can be flexible on. You can work, you can negotiate. But when it comes to core principles, when it comes to things like, I want to ban Muslims in your name as an American citizen. I want to separate families from children in your name. Those are things that you can't be flexible on. That, you know, when it comes to the character of our country, when it comes to who we are as a people, those are things that we all have to stand up and raise our voice and encourage other people to do the same thing as well.
But I know you're speaking from one side. I'm sorry to create a binary, but one side of the argument from your experience at the State Department. How about other colleagues at the State Department who say, well, you know, maybe this is working. Maybe this temporary ban is not such a bad idea.
Yeah, and I have lots of discussions and debates with people who are still in the State Department. What they would say is that, well, the ban is pointless, but, you know, at least we're giving this president something that's minimal. That, you know, that instead of banning 20 Muslim countries, we're only banning 7. And we have a waiver process. And we have, you know, diluted this discrimination to the point where it's really not that bad. That's the typical reaction I get from people in the State Department that, you know, it's just a couple thousand or 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people who are affected by this. And therefore, you know, we shouldn't, we should just be glad that we're able to mold this to be something that's not that bad. I think that that's the argument that I hear from them.
Well, now that you're no longer part of a government agency, I'm curious about how you're watching the news, you know, what's going on at the NATO summit last week, for example, or the summit in Helsinki today. Or who are you on the sidelines of this, Chris?
I think that for a lot of us, you know, we think that the thing about a diplomat and the thing about the State Department is that we're always really well prepared for our meetings. We write lots of memos, lots of cables. We do lots of research before we meet with people. And so, you know, I think for us, we're always like kind of horrified when people have meetings off the cuff or on the fly. I think it's just an entirely different way of thinking about things. And I think that that's something that this president does. And you have to give this president credit. He is doing everything that he promised he would do on the campaign trail. And it's a question of whether us in the State Department are going to do everything that we promised that we would do when he was making those promises back then in 2015 and in 2016.
I'm speaking with Chris Richardson, former U.S. diplomat who left the State Department. He now works on the, let's say, opposite side of the law when it comes to immigration policy. And let's talk about that a little bit. The law firm that you're working for now in Atlanta, how do they feel about you being so vocal about your criticism for this administration?
I'm sure for some people it's somewhat uncomfortable. I'm sure for others it isn't. But my primary focus is on helping our clients and you know, representing our clients in these roles, but also, you know, doing a lot of pro bono cases and trying to help as many immigrants as we possibly can.
One of the cases that you were working on was in Morristown, Tennessee. And this was the scene of one of the biggest ICE raids since the Trump administration began. 97 people, I believe, picked up at a meatpacking plant there. What did you do there in Morristown?
I went out to Morristown to basically talk to like about 70 or 60 of those individuals who were picked up, or probably closer to 50 or 60 of those individuals who had been picked up in this ICE raid, just to talk to them about what their legal rights were and to try to find a solution to avoid deportation for them. It's a really tragic story because these people were so embedded in the community there in Morristown, but a lot of them are under threat basically of deportation.
Tell us a little bit about that. It's an interesting case. Since the 1990s, Morristown had seen a lot of migrant workers. It's a big tomato picking center of the country. But people had been somewhat integrated. How did residents respond after that ICE raid?
Overwhelmingly positive. In terms of actually supporting the migrants, that, you know, they raised tens of thousands of dollars to help migrant families. They've knocked on doors. Churches have welcomed these people into their communities, into their churches. And so the community in Morristown was stunned by the ICE raid and really felt that they had to do something to help these individuals who were arrested and under threat of deportation.
What gets revealed in a situation like that where you have a small town, 30,000 people or something like that, and their response to this kind of federal policy? I'm curious how you saw that play out.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, I think 70% of the people in this town voted for President Trump. And I think that it goes to this thing that, you know, when immigrants are from afar, you know, and they're not my immigrants or my migrants, then, you know, they're the worst things in the world. But when there are people that you know and people that you love and people that, you know, you bake cookies for and they bake cookies for you and you've traded sugar with, when there are people that are involved in your life and you're personally affected by it and you see the face of it, I think that that has the power to change your opinion. And I think that's what you're seeing in Morristown is that, you know, a lot of people felt that, well, you know, when he said he was going to ban the Muslims and he said he was going to stop immigration, I didn't realize he meant that meant my town as well. And that it sort of opens a window into this idea that, you know, discrimination is only bad when it affects me and my family personally, but that we all have to be aware and have to fight for the rights of others, that the luxury of being sick of all this stuff is only for those who aren't affected by it. But your day of worry and being affected by it is coming. And that's something we always have to be aware of.
Historically, it is that one-on-one, the human interaction that has changed the way that law and policy works in this country. I'm thinking of gay marriage, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, for many years it was thought to be no way that's going to happen. But then as more and more people knew somebody in their family or friends who was gay, that shifted.
Right.
I wonder what, how you're seeing that play out in the United States today. What was the human interaction for you that changed things?
I think that, you know, growing up in a small town, or not in Charleston itself, but outside of Charleston, like, for example, I didn't know many Muslims before. I lived in a Muslim country, and, you know, the people who defended me and protected me were Muslim. And I took part in understanding in Muslim culture and tradition in these various different countries. That's something that changed me personally. I think that growing up in an interracial house at a time when that wasn't really a popular thing also changed me and also changed my perspective on how, you know, we see each other, whether we're white or we're black or whatever race we are. I think that we all have to be willing to open our hearts and our minds to other people. And I think that we've seen that now in this country, and we'll continue to see that.
Chris, any regrets about leaving the State Department?
At this point, no. I do regret that I burned a lot of bridges with a lot of friends. But I think that this is far more valuable and far more important that people know that not everyone in the State Department believes in this stuff, that not everyone in the government believes in this stuff, that, you know, a lot of us are out there, you know, fighting against it, that we left the State Department and we're fighting to make our country great again. That's the way I would put it.
Chris, I'm getting a glimpse of something I didn't know very much about before. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris Richardson, a former U.S. diplomat, he resigned from the State Department. He's now an immigration attorney in Atlanta. And that is it for our show for today. As always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter and call. Tell us what you're thinking. We're at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.